Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Today, President Obama will hear from General Stanley McChrystal. He's the commander in Afghanistan via secure video from Kabul. It's the first of several meetings on the topic that is before everybody in Washington these days, which is, what are we going to do in Afghanistan? Since last week, the debate has simmered over the general's request for some 40,000 additional troops on the ground. Here to sift through the arguments and give us his perspective on the situation in is OSU military history professor. He is the Raymond E. Mason Jr. Chair of Military History at OSU, Peter Mansour. He's also a retired Army colonel who is among the advisory group that helped the Joint Chiefs sort out a strategy in Iraq a few years ago. Welcome.
Thanks, Mansour. Nice to be here.
What is your sense about the process that's occurring right now regarding the president's decision on how many troops to send or whether or not – is this process normal? Is this feel right to you?
It does feel right. What's made it feel sort of out of sorts is the fact that General McChrystal's assessment on the situation in Afghanistan, which was a classified assessment, was leaked to the media. Had it not been leaked, I think Americans would have gone on their lives with no issue about what how the process was unfolding. President is holding a number of national security meetings behind closed doors. There will be a lot of people in the room: the Vice President, the Secretary of Defense, Secretary of State, National Security Advisor, the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Petraeus, the Commander of Central Command. And of course, the commander on the ground, General Stanley McChrystal, from via video teleconference link from Kabul. So these people will meet. They'll probably have several meetings on the issue, maybe up to three or five, and they'll sort out the various strategic options that are before the United States and its allies and Afghanistan. And figure out where they want to go from here. Clearly, the war is not gone the way we wanted it to go. It's a lot more difficult than this president envisioned when he said that this was a war of necessity, not of choice. And the fact that the 20,000 additional forces that the president authorized to deploy to Afghanistan this year haven't done the job, I think, has been somewhat surprising to this administration. And so they're taking a step back. And they're looking at their strategy again, the strategy they stated in the white paper last March that said we're going to do a counterinsurgency strategy in Afghanistan. And they're saying, okay, do we really want to do this? What are the other options and can they work?
And 20,000, the question is, was 20,000 not enough or was the whole approach wrong?
I think they're going to ask both those questions. I don't think the approach was wrong, personally, having implemented a similar approach in Iraq. And we can talk about the various strategic options. I'm sure we will today. But 20,000 troops clearly is insufficient. We knew that back in March. It was a down payment.
What did they ask for in March?
The commander on the ground at the time was General McKiernan, and he asked for 37,000. So the president authorized a portion of that. But even 37,000 wasn't going to be enough, given the strength of the Taliban, the growing strength of the Taliban, and the growing levels of violence in the country. One of the things that we looked at when we redid the counterinsurgency field manual in 2006 was how many security force personnel does it really take to secure a society that's racked with violence and is undergoing a serious insurgency? And a historically based number, which is a rule of thumb, it's not a hard and fast rule, is about one security force person for every 50 people. By way of comparison, in New York City, you have about 8.2 million people and 39,000 cops. So that's about one security force person for every 200 people.
Okay.
So you need probably about four times as many as you would.
I say New York's bad enough, but
– it's not that bad, though. Yeah, so about four times as many as you would need in a peaceful environment. In Afghanistan, you would look at the population, about 32 million. It's a big mountainous country, a lot of real estate to cover, bigger than the state of California. So you'd need about 580,000 people in uniform or carrying arms and working towards stability. And those could be actually local tribal people that you would arm and put on your side as well. But we're not nowhere near that figure right now. The Afghan army is working up towards a figure of about 137,000.
The Afghan army.
The police are, approaching maybe 100,000. The U.S. forces, after we get all our forces on the ground that have been authorized, we'll have 68,000. NATO has 33, but that adds up to about half the number
of
required.
What is necessary. Okay.
Right. And so in the long run, what you want to see is the Afghan army built up, the Afghan police built up, and that they we get the numbers we need out of the local host nation. But that's a long process, especially in a place like Afghanistan, where the leadership cadres you need just don't exist.
And the counterinsurgency, you need all the numbers down on the ground, but you also have to have a whole different attitude in a place like Afghanistan about how you're interacting with the people and working with them to help them help themselves. It's different.
Classic counterinsurgency strategy would say that you want to support the legitimate government and that to do that, you have to provide security to the people, to make it impossible for insurgents to live among the people and co-opt them or intimidate them into supporting the insurgency. Once you provide the people security and then you can make their lives better with the provision of basic services, it helps increase the legitimacy of the government and the insurgency withers away and eventually peters out. What is different in Afghanistan right now is the problem that the Afghan government is having with the fraudulent elections and lack of legitimacy. The first thing that President Obama needs to ask is this government legitimate? And if it's not, can we push it in a direction where it will become legitimate? Because if the answer is no, that it'll never be a legitimate government, then classic counterinsurgency strategy cannot work.
That was a big setback when there was all the problems in the fraudulent voting and the ballot box stuffing and whatever they did. They're not even sure anymore what everything went on. And they're thinking that they're not going to have the follow-up election until next spring either.
Or maybe they won't have an election.
At all.
You know, one of the possibilities is we could pressure Karzai to bring his rivals into the government and make a unity government. That would be probably a fairly good outcome. Unfortunately, I think what happened is Karzai has promised a lot of deals to a lot of nefarious actors and warlords, and he'd have to backtrack on those deals in order to bring his rivals into the power with him.
If you do have those additional 40,000 on the ground in the spring and you have another runoff election, that sounds sort of combustible in a way that Or would it be better?
Another runoff election will be combustible no matter when you have it. The Taliban sees that they've found a chink in the armor, if you will, of the Afghan government, and it will work to make whatever elections come up very unstable. And their power rests in the Pashtun areas in the southern and eastern portions of Afghanistan. If they can prevent the Pashtun people from voting, then what you might see is a non-Pashtun president elected. Abdullah, the number two guy, number two vote getter, is a Tajik, half Pashtun, but he's widely seen as a Tajik. And then the Taliban could point to that and say, see, we told you that they were going to put a non-Pashtun in power, and therefore you need to support us. The Pashtuns, by the way, have governed Afghanistan since time immemorial.
And it is a very, very old country.
It's an old
place.
Yes,
I guess country
sure
was the wrong
country,
word.
Yeah.
Old place. John Meacham in Newsweek, the latest Newsweek, he said that the troops, quote, troops and a political touch by General Petraeus helped stabilize Iraq. What's the political touch part of it?
Well, we realized in Iraq that we weren't going to kill our way to victory. We had to reach out to the people that were in opposition to the Iraqi government and bring them, as many of them, into the process as we could. It was actually the British officers, senior officers, Graham Lamb and others in Baghdad, who, you know, looked at us across the desk and said, we were in Northern Ireland for many years, and what we finally realized, we being the British Army, is you don't reconcile with your friends, you reconcile with your enemies. And so we realized that we had to reach out and find those reconcilable elements in both the insurgency and among the Shiite militias. And we were able to do that successfully because the surge and the provision of more U.S. forces to the conflict changed the psychological dynamic. The actors on the ground realized the United States was not leaving, that we were going all in. And that changed their viewpoint. And there were a number of them that said, okay, America's here to stay. They're actually our best hope for stability. We can actually work with them. And maybe this government in Baghdad isn't so bad after all if we can become part of it. And it's that sort of political touch that helped to turn the situation around.
In an article about General McChrystal, it described he's taking a different tack just mood-wise. He doesn't let them plow out through the streets of Kabul in their big, giant vehicles. And he actually discourages some of his troops from wearing the body armor and that sort of thing because he wants them to feel and understand how vulnerable the people are there.
If you're going to protect the people, you can't on one hand protect them and on the other hand push them away by being very rude and not just rude but dangerous to them. The way these convoys were driving in Iraq first and I guess in Afghanistan, I've never been there, but they go down the roads. They are concerned about suicide bombers and roadside bombs, and therefore they push traffic off to the shoulders and they speed and they're very dangerous. And I think what General McChrystal realized is he can't keep alienating the Afghan people on the one hand and then on the other hand tell them, well we're here to protect you. And so he laid out the guidelines to his troops and hopefully they're having some impact. But that's actually a minor thing.
It is a minor thing.
Right now there is a growing insurgency. The Taliban have the upper hand because in a counterinsurgency, if you're not winning, you're losing. And we have to arrest this downward spiral and get the situation spiraling back upward in a positive direction. If we can't do that within a reasonable period of time, then we're going to lose this war. And there's a lot of bad ramifications that are going to come from that.
Okay, we're going to take a short break. I'm speaking with retired Army Colonel Peter Mansour. He was among the group that helped the Joint Chiefs of Staff sort out a strategy in Iraq a few years ago, and we're talking about the options that lay before us now in Afghanistan. If you would like to join the conversation, call 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is WOSU 820 NPR News. We'll be right back.
David Patterson declares that whatever the White House said, he still plans to run for governor and reaffirmed his qualifications.
I'm blind, but I'm not oblivious.
I'm Neil Conan. Plus, are you eagerly awaiting Sarah Palin's memoirs?
Darn right.
Going Rogue hits bookstores early. Ken Rudin? He'll be here on time. The Political Junkie joins us next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation begins later this afternoon. It starts at 2, right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. 51 degrees in downtown Columbus at 1020.
Support for WOSU comes from the estate of Donald R. Glancy, whose life was enriched by public radio and television, and whose bequest seeks to encourage others to discover WOSU public media.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News. There is a frost advisory in effect from 2 a.m. until 9 a.m. for Thursday.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm speaking with retired Army Colonel Peter Mansour, who currently is a military history professor at OSU. He is the Raymond E. Mason Jr. Chair of Military History at OSU. We're talking about Afghanistan. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call at 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Let's take a call right now from Ken. Ken, you're on the air.
Yes. My understanding is the Obama administration came out even before this election and called Karzai not necessarily a crook, but a horse trader. And with opium, there was a case where they arrested five people with drugs. He let them off. And my point is, my understanding is that his security force is made up of Americans. That's who his security force is, are American contractors. Why not just tell him that, you know, if this is going to continue, America cannot guarantee his security or his safety.
Okay.
And put leverage on him.
Okay. Thanks, Ken.
Well, actually, David Kilcullen, who's a counterinsurgency expert, calls that the 12x14 diplomacy. That is, you blow up a glossy 12x14 picture of the last president of Afghanistan who was executed when the Taliban took power back in the early 90s, and you frame it and you trot it into his office and you put it before him and you say, do you want to look like that? Because if you don't clean up your act, that's what you're going to look like. Karzai's regime is extremely corrupt. His brother is trafficking in opium. A lot of other members of the government benefit from the trade. And it's this corruption that has to be dealt with. Otherwise, this government will never become legitimate. And unless the government becomes legitimate, then anything we do in terms of a counterinsurgency campaign to protect the people is for naught in the long run. The question is what alternatives do we have? Karzai does have some support. It's not like he is without support. He did obviously stuff the ballot boxes, but he does outpoll in scientific polling other candidates. Now, that doesn't mean we should blindly support him. I think, you know, this crisis is too good to pass up. We need to use the leverage we have from this crisis to force reforms in the Afghan government, or perhaps we do threaten to get out, and maybe that will shock this government into either accepting some sort of unity government where the opposition candidates are included, or putting it on a path to cleaning its act up and providing the Afghan people the kind of governance that they deserve.
There have been a lot of comparisons in the past week to the Vietnam War and to what President Johnson faced when he took over and some of the decisions he made. What do you think about those comparisons as a military history?
It's not a bad analogy to the early 60s when we had a very corrupt president of South Vietnam, President Diem, who did have, however, some support among elements of the South Vietnamese population. But we felt, well, we never can get a legitimate government under him. Therefore, we're going to support a coup against him, which we did. He was deposed. Unfortunately, what came after him was even worse. And the government that came after him was seen as a puppet government of the United States, which in effect it was. So it's easy to say, well, let's just get rid of Karzai and install someone of our choosing. But then we own the government, and it will never become legitimate that way either. So I think that's a easy solution that unfortunately is very wrong as well.
And the other decisions you mentioned earlier, that what's before the president now is if he accepts General McChrystal's recommendation, if he embraces that, they continue on that course and it continues to be a general's war, and it shows faith in his military. But if they choose not to do that, you said, now the administration owns the war.
Well, the commander's on the ground. The commander on the ground has given his best military advice. And that advice, as I understand it, has been supported by General Petraeus in Tampa and by Admiral Mullen in Washington. If the administration turns around and says, thank you for your military advice, we're going to do something different, the administration now owns the consequences because it's ignored the advice of its three most senior military leaders who have responsibility for the conflict. So there are no easy solutions for this administration. And I think rightfully it's relooking its strategy. I think in the end it'll come to the same conclusion. Hopefully it'll come to the same conclusion General McChrystal did. that a counterinsurgency campaign, provided we can get a government that's worth supporting, is the best path to success. Look, you know, Stanley McChrystal is a special operator almost his entire career. If anyone can look at this situation and say, we can solve our dilemma by implementing a pure counterterrorist approach, it would be Stan McChrystal. And yet he's looked at the situation and said, we can't win that way. And he was the joint special operator in Iraq, the commander of Joint Special Operations Command in Iraq, which did a very successful counterterrorist campaign against al-Qaeda Iraq operatives. But even there, what we saw is that even though we could get hundreds and thousands of al-Qaeda terrorists off the streets of Iraq, it was not enough. To collapse a network like that that's embedded among the people, you got to have a synergy between conventional and special forces that we simply don't have in Afghanistan yet.
Is the 40,000 that the general's asking for, is that like a surge that occurred in Afghanistan, I mean, in Iraq? Is that the same?
I think you could look at it that way. It's a temporary increase, but temporary is, you know, there's a lot of ways to define that term. In Iraq, the surge was 18 months. I think it's going to be a little longer than that in Afghanistan because the situation is far worse.
Yeah.
It will not be a permanent increase. What he's trying to do is knock the Taliban back on their heels, because right now they've got the upper hand. The reason the Taliban won't negotiate in any kind of sincerity with either the Karzai government or with U.S. Interlocutors is they think they're winning. So why should they negotiate? The Taliban have to see that they're on a path to defeat before they're going to reach out and say, okay, let's talk about this. And that 40,000 troops will help us do that. At the same time, it buys us time to help grow the Afghan army and police forces. And to embed our advisory teams in there, help reduce the corruption among the police, which is a huge problem, and help us build Afghan government capacity as well. Provided we can get an Afghan government that we can put on the path to legitimacy.
There's obviously lots of comparisons between Afghanistan now and Iraq before the surge. Is it that simple? Are those comparisons useful?
I think they are.
Okay.
We heard a lot of the same kind of pontificating in 2006, that a civil war was inevitable, that anything we did was not going to have any kind of long-term impact, that a military solution just wasn't what we needed. What we needed was benchmarks and political movement. And what we saw in Afghanistan or in Iraq was that political progress was simply not going to occur until we could reduce the levels of ethno-sectarian violence. I think the parallel in Afghanistan is you will not see any kind of political solution to the way Afghanistan is going to be governed in the future until the Taliban realize that they cannot win this war militarily, because right now they think they can.
This is All Sides with Dan Fisher, WOSU 820. If you'd like to join the conversation with Professor Mansour of OSU, call 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We have a caller on the line now. Jerry, you'd like to talk about
alternative. Colonel and Ms. Fisher. Yes, well, only speaking from a historical standpoint, and George Santayana said, those who do not learn from history are condemned to repeat it. Alexander the Great couldn't beat the Afghans. How many years ago was that? The Brits and the Russians were in there in the early part of the 19th century, and the Russians again in the last century, and they pulled out. And the thing is, the original mission, as I understand it, Colonel, was to get Osama bin Laden. And I also understand that Karzai, and you brought out about his two brothers are accused of dealing drugs, and he was a consultant for UNICAL of California, Union Oil of California, and he's really only the mayor of Kabul. And I am reminded of what General William Westmoreland back in the Vietnam days, we just need a few thousand more. We just need a few thousand more until the U.S. had 500,000 men in, and it just, please, Colonel, I'll hang up, and I would appreciate your stating what is the mission. That is what any military man wants to know. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jerry.
I think the mission has morphed over the last 8 years, quite frankly. It was to root out Al-Qaeda, but it was also to destroy the Taliban regime, which harbored Al-Qaeda. We did that successfully. We did destroy the Taliban regime. Unfortunately, we didn't put the number of forces in there and conduct the kind of campaign needed to actually bottle up Al-Qaeda and prevent them from escaping across the border into Pakistan, the Battle of Tora Bora back in 2001. So the question is now, how do we get at Al-Qaeda, which is in Pakistan? If you withdraw from Afghanistan, you lose any kind of leverage you have in terms of bases in Afghanistan, in terms of your relationship with Pakistani authorities, because the Pakistanis have seen this movie before. They realize the United States is only there for its own national interests. It tends to stay for short periods of time, and then it leaves. And unless we can prove to the Pakistanis that we're going to be there for the long run, why is it in Pakistan's interests to help us root out Al-Qaeda in the Northwest Frontier Province or in the federally administered tribal areas? It's not. They'd rather just cut deals with Al-Qaeda and let it live and let live. We have a great deal of leverage over the situation by our presence in Afghanistan, but we have to prove to the actors on the ground that we're going to be there for the long run. Now, what makes me think that this is going to be different from Alexander the Great or the Russians? The fact is those forces came as conquerors, were there in order to stand up, hopefully, a legitimate government that can meet the needs of the Afghan people. If you look at the polling data right now, the United States, as bad as we're doing, still polls about a 64% approval rating among the Afghan people. The Taliban, on the other hand, polls 4%. The Afghan people are not really looking forward to having the Taliban back as their government, and that gives us a bit of hope for the future. You know, we don't have to go down the path that the Russians or the British or the Greeks went down, in the past. The other thing you have to look at are the consequences of withdrawal, because let's say we accept the caller's contention that this is a fool's errand and we just need to get out. The second order effects are the first order effects would be probably a Taliban takeover of a good portion of Afghanistan, as they did in the 1990s. The second order effect will be increased Taliban operations inside Pakistan and potentially a toppling of the democratic government there in Islamabad. And then you have the Taliban, the Pakistani Taliban, that control 50 nuclear weapons. You have Al-Qaeda that's undefeated and has unfettered access now to the levers of the state in Pakistan. And you've now destabilized a major U.S. strategic ally on the border in India. And then the third order effect is you've given the extremists yet another seeming victory over a superpower. Their narrative is that the jihadists defeated the Soviet Union in the 1980s. Their secondary narrative now would be that they defeated the United States, that they're invincible, that they can defeat superpowers if they are just, willing enough to stay the course. And I think that will undoubtedly and eventually lead to expanded extremist movements across the Islamic world and, unfortunately, more terrorist attacks in the West.
You know, there's lots of people like Jerry out there who pay very, very close attention to these issues, and they're very concerned. Someone said this week that it will be good for General McChrystal to be heard by the American public. Is the American public qualified to judge? How do you feel about that when the public opinion gets into the picture?
The American people, obviously have the right to understand what's going on, understand the situation. But the president needs to lead. The president needs to make the judgment. And I'll go back to the fall of 2006. As bad as the decisions President Bush made in his first 6 years in office, his last 2 years were fairly inspired in terms of his ability to act as a commander-in-chief. He made the decision to surge against every piece of political advice that everyone in his party and the other party were giving him, and against the opposition of the American people. And yet he saw it through. He said, this is the way we're going to go. I'm the commander-in-chief, this is my decision. I'm going to give you every piece of support that I can give you to carry it out, you being General Petraeus. And he stuck that through in the last 2 years of his presidency and, in fact, put Iraq on a path to stability that it hopefully will stay on now. President Obama needs to exhibit the same kind of presidential leadership in this crisis. He cannot just sway with the opinion polls. The American people really want to see this war on a path to success. What they don't want is a sort of a conflict that carries on forever with no clear path to victory.
We're going to take another short break. I'm speaking with Professor Peter Mansour. He's a retired Army colonel who is among the committee of strategists that helped the Joint Chiefs of Staff work out a plan in Iraq a few years ago. He teaches military history these days at OSU, and today we're talking about some history in the making, how the president will use the advice of his commander in Afghanistan. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News. We'll be right back.
WOSU Public Media and PBS present an epic story based on a radical idea that the most special places in the nation should be preserved, not for royalty or for the rich, but for everyone. Evenings this week at 8 p.m., watch Ken Burns' six-part series, The National Parks, America's Best Idea, on WOSU-TV. You can visit WOSU.org for complete listings and more information.
This is WOSU 820 NPR News. Thanks for joining us for All Sides with Ann Fisher this morning. In 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, Hour 2 of All Sides will be here. We'll hear two points of view about the Solid Waste Authority of Central Ohio's plan to increase revenue by ending a waiver program and possible state legislation to limit SWACO's authority. That's on All Sides with Ann Fisher at 11 o'clock right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. In the weather forecast, it's currently 51 degrees in downtown Columbus. Some sunshine breaking through the clouds this afternoon and a high of 62. Clear skies tonight with patchy frost after midnight, a low of 38. There is a frost advisory in effect from the National Weather Service from 2 a.m. until 9 a.m. for Thursday morning. And then for the rest of Thursday, sunshine in the afternoon and a high of 68. You're listening to WOSU 820 NPR News. And now back to All Sides with Ann Fisher.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Professor Peter Mansour has joined us today to discuss the question before President Obama, whether to send another 40,000 troops to Afghanistan. The professor is a retired Army colonel who worked on strategy in Iraq, including the surge in 2007. He teaches military history at OSU these days. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call at 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Let's take some callers right now. Subhash, you're on the air.
Yes.
Welcome.
Okay, thank you. I read in the newspaper just recently that Taliban got funding of about, either $106 million or $106 billion last year. What's the source of funding? Where's the money coming from to finance this operation?
Good question. And there are actually two major sources of funding. One is, and the obvious one is from the opium trade. They force Afghan farmers, actually they don't need to force them because it's pretty lucrative for them, to grow opium poppies. And then they collect it, process it, and sell it. And that obviously gets them a bunch of income that way. And it's probably in the hundreds of millions of dollars. Not, I would be surprised if it were upwards of a billion. But General McChrystal recently came out and said, even if we stop the opium production today, the Taliban would still have funding, and he's correct. And that goes to the second source, which is there are still sources within the Gulf countries that believe in this cause, and they funnel money, you know, via the banking system to the Taliban. And so we really need to cut off both sources of funding. We need to work with our allies in the Middle East and the Gulf countries to choke off that source of funding while we conduct a counter-drug campaign in Afghanistan and force the farmers to plant legitimate crops like wheat and pomegranates and fruit and so forth.
You know, one of the things about the opium trade economy there is it's really the only economy right now that's substantial and that can support people, and that part of this war has to be creating, building the new infrastructure, getting the schools back on track, creating and educating people to take on jobs other than
opium production.
Other than opium production, it's the same old argument. If you want to feed your family, you can feed them more with that.
But it is an agricultural economy. I think, you know, we're on a fool's errand if we want to turn this into South Korea. It's not going to have a manufacturing base to speak of. It's not going to have a high-tech industry. We need to play to their strengths, and their strengths are agriculture, and that's where we should be putting the majority of our effort. But what we need to do is get them to produce legitimate agriculture, wheat.
Help them market it. Help them get it out there.
That's right. Maybe even provide an artificial market for the first few years. Assure them that we'll buy the crop. And that will wean them off the opium poppy as their source of livelihood.
Let's take another call from Steve. You want to talk about Pakistan? You're on the air.
Yeah, hello.
Hi.
Yeah, the professor mentioned earlier that one of our fear is that the Taliban might take over Pakistan and control the nukes. Now, my question is it really realistic to think that Taliban might take over Pakistan unless a major portion of the Pakistani military is sympathetic to them? I mean, compare that to, take for example, India taking over Pakistan. Is that going to be possible? I think they will fight to the death. But if the Taliban are going to take over Pakistan, there's going to be some sympathy within the military itself. So I think what we're trying to do is fight a war that the Pakistani themselves really don't believe in. So, can we ever be successful?
Okay, Steve, thanks for your comments and your question.
Unfortunately, what we saw in the 1990s when we cut off our ties to Pakistan based on its exploding a nuclear device is that there were elements of the Pakistani military that did become aligned with the Taliban and with al-Qaeda, and they became fairly extremist in their viewpoint, and the extremist Islam was penetrating the Pakistani military. So I think what we need to look at is what level of risk are we going to take here? If we allow Afghanistan to fall, and are we just going to take the risk that the Pakistani military can hold the line against al-Qaeda and the Taliban and prevent a takeover of that state? Because I think the jury's out on that. The Taliban are very patient, as is al-Qaeda. And over years and decades, they may be able to infiltrate, and they probably would be able to infiltrate the Pakistani military and eventually collapse the state from within. And then they have what they want, which is a base for operations, one that has 173 million people, modern communications infrastructure, a lot of military gear, and nuclear weapons.
Most importantly, the nuclear weapons.
Yeah.
So we pour in 40,000 troops. We get them on the ground there and maybe more in time, bringing in the grand total to about 100,000 or what is it, about?
68,000 now, okay. So that'll put it up to about 110. You have about 33,000, 35,000 NATO troops. Be nice to, have them follow our lead and at least hold the line and not withdraw them. And then you put in and ramp up the advisory effort to really grow the Afghan forces. And again, that will arrest the downward spiral in the security situation. knock the Taliban back on their heels, because there has to be a kinetic component to this. You can't, you know, as you're protecting the people, you do need to be going after the bad guys. And then over a period of a few years, you'll be able to turn the security situation over to the Afghan forces. But again, it assumes that the Afghan government is going to reform. Now, that is, again, the first strategic question we have to answer.
And so the Taliban moves its – shifts its, you know, operations to Pakistan. It starts working and hunkering down over there. I'm wondering, you know, we increase the troops on the ground in Afghanistan.
How do we get at their sanctuaries?
What's the reaction in Pakistan to something like that? Because, you know, they're not our bosom buddies.
I think it's favorable, though.
Okay.
What they are looking for is a long-term commitment of the United States to the region. And right now they don't see it. And if they do see that commitment, then I think they're going to be much more willing to work with us to chip away at the sanctuaries within their own borders. Otherwise, they're going to play both sides of the fence. There are significant elements of the Pakistani intelligence services that see the Taliban as a bulwark against Indian encroachment. You know, the Pakistanis, it doesn't make sense to us, but it makes sense to them, see Afghanistan as an Indian plot to surround them. And therefore, there are elements in the Pakistani intelligence services that support the Taliban. They view them as their proxy forces, and it creates a stable flank so that they can face off against their major threat, which is India.
Yeah, Connie, you're on the air. You wanted to ask about India.
Yes, I did. I don't understand why India isn't more concerned and isn't backing us up more. Because their main threat is Pakistan, and Pakistan feels that India is. Seems to me India has a lot more to lose than we do. Why aren't they more involved? And for that reason, why isn't China? It's on the border of Pakistan.
Okay, Connie, thanks a lot.
Actually, India has been a very reliable ally for the United States. But when you say get involved, the question is how can they get involved in a way that makes sense? They certainly can't send forces to Afghanistan to support the effort there. That would play into the fears that the Pakistanis have of encirclement. Where they could really support us is in coming to some sort of agreement with Pakistan on the Kashmir situation. But that's not in the cards. I mean, both sides view Kashmir as their land, and I don't think that's going to change anytime soon. You know, what we'd like to see is Afghanistan or Pakistan and India come to some sort of terms on Kashmir and reduce the threat of a flashpoint there. And in that sense, India could be a little bit more forthcoming, but really the ball is in Pakistan's court. And given the amount of extremist activity within Pakistani borders right now, I don't see that happening.
General George Casey, the Army Chief of Staff, he said that he is concerned that there may not be the capacity to provide more soldiers without causing too much stress on the larger force. And isn't that something that we were hearing before the surge in Iraq too?
Right, and the Army didn't break.
Right.
However, we're going to have about 100,000 more troops here shortly as we withdraw down to withdraw forces from Iraq and draw down to 50,000 troops there by August of 2010. So I think this is a short-term issue at best. I believe the Army could find the forces, activate National Guard if you had to, but in the long term, given the fact that we're going to go down to 50,000 in Iraq by 2010 and zero by the end of 2011, the forces are there.
Activating the National Guard, isn't that kind of part of the problem back in the States? People are frustrated. That's not what they got into the National Guard for. They were gung-ho some years ago, and now that's waning.
Well, the question is, if they don't want to fight a war, then why are they in the National Guard?
Okay, I mean.
It's you could say, well, it's a strategic reserve for the big one, but how many world wars do we suffer? The last one was 1945. So, you know, I understand the issue of it's a state force for disaster relief and whatnot, but I think the National Guard is there to help fight our wars. And we used it up front in the Iraqi conflict in 2003-04. There's been a number of years since where it's been able to reconstitute. So I think if we had to activate a few more brigades for a year or so, that we could do that.
Sources inside the White House, I love that phrase, have said that Colin Powell is not convinced that more troops would guarantee success. Is there ever a guarantee? Like you said, 40,000, there's a lot of depends in there.
I agree with the good general. A million troops couldn't guarantee success. The question is what is the best, what is our best estimate of what is required to carry out our chosen strategy? If we're going to conduct a counterinsurgency campaign in Afghanistan to protect the people, we're going to need more troops. It's as plain as simple as that. And there's obviously a limit on the number that the Army and the Marine Corps can provide, given that we're a long service professional force and we're not going to reinstitute the draft and grow the Army as significantly. The question is the number that General McChrystal's asking for, and we don't know that it's 40,000. It could be more or less than that. Is that enough to get the job done? And if not, what are the other alternatives?
Is it possible that he's sort of taking it, even that number, whatever it is a compromise in his own mind, that there's so much opposition to even the 40,000, or that he wouldn't ask for the 50 or 60 that he really thinks he needs? Is that possible?
I hope not, because the job of a commander on the ground is to tell the leader in Washington what he needs to succeed. And then it's up to the leader in Washington to say, well, you can't have that many. I can give you that many, or no, you can't. This is what you're going to get. And then the commander on the ground needs to come back and say, okay, this is the risk I'm incurring to the successful accomplishment of this mission if I only get X number. That's the sort of dialogue that needs to occur. The commander on the ground should not sort of look at the political tea leaves and say, well, they're only going to give me 40,000, so that's all I'm going to request. He's not doing the troops on the ground he's not giving them his best leadership if he does that. And knowing General McChrystal, I don't think he is.
In remarks to the news media the other day, the new NATO Secretary General Anders Rasmussen said that we should stay there however long it takes to succeed, but not forever. And he said that several times. I'm wondering, where is the line in the sand on something like this? How do you look at it that way?
Yeah.
How much can we take?
You know, it's a great question. If we're there to build some sort of modern nation state in South Asia, we will be there forever or near forever. I think if we pare down our goals to creating some sort of stable situation that where there's a government that can control its borders and prevent Al-Qaeda from setting up shop again inside Afghanistan, that the needs of the people are met within their own cultural context, which is, you know, not a lot, you know, clean water and food and shelter. Then I think with those sort of limited goals, we could get out much more quickly than forever. But it will take a number of years. We have let this conflict deteriorate for 8 years now. We haven't really put our best effort into winning it. And I think we owe it to ourselves and the Afghan people to make that effort before we decide that it's impossible. But I don't think it is. I think we can get this done. If we get the right government there on the ground, and if we put our resources and time into supporting it.
Yeah, I can still remember that day when they were dropping the leaflets from the, you know, sky to the Afghan people, and they started playing the music. And it's, to me, almost as memorable to me as the day they invaded Iraq, in terms of sort of that iconic sense of we've started something.
The Afghan people were very grateful for their liberation from the Taliban. We shouldn't forget that.
Right.
But then we sort of ignored them. It was this early Bush administration, Donald Rumsfeld approach that 55 guys on horseback and some satellite radios could win any war we decided to win. And then we could leave the state building and the stability operations to other people. We have found that to be an egregious mistake. I think anyone who looked at history would have seen that up front. And we're rectifying those errors, unfortunately, way too late and at great cost.
Yeah, I mean, some folks say that it is too late, that the only way to win would have been to win 8 years ago.
Well, the only way to win cheaply would have been to win 8 years ago.
Okay.
We're a big country. We've got a huge economy, even in its current state. We've got a very talented population, a great military. And again, if we get a government that's worth supporting on the ground there, we can win this conflict.
Just one more. I know we're getting up there to the end of the hour. Yeah, 2 minutes. Okay. What about the president's decision to speak directly with General McChrystal just once since the general assumed command in June? There's been criticism of that. One observer, someone from the Brookings Institution, I think, called that out of touch. Is that – what do you think about that?
It's not out of touch at all. It's actually pretty standard fare for presidents in wartime. It's unusual, actually, to have a president that talks directly to his commander in the field constantly. Lincoln did it via telegraph. President Bush did it with weekly VTCs with General Petraeus in Baghdad. But the normal way is to go through the chain of command and to talk to the Secretary of Defense, the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and the Commander of Central Command, not to reach down to the commander in Kabul and continually ping him with questions. That's, again, the president's prerogative, how he wants to lead. But I don't see it as unusual that he hasn't talked to General McChrystal.
We only have a few more seconds, but I was wondering about what goes on in these meetings, these several meetings they're going to start having with General McChrystal. Does he have a – is it a general overview? Does it always start with that?
I can only talk to, what the meetings were like with General Petraeus. But General Petraeus would usually begin – the president would, start the meeting and then turn it over to the folks in Baghdad. General Petraeus would give us a briefing of the situation on the ground, or if it was a briefing on the new strategy, he would give an outline of his okay. thoughts, and then the president would weigh in, and then there would be a discourse.
Okay. Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. I'd like to thank my guest, OSU history professor and retired colonel with the U.S. Army, Peter Mansour. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for having me on.
This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.